This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The president is back on the stump this week, drumming again for support for the Iraq War. But in Congress, they're looking at the bill. Another $67 billion in supplemental spending, mainly for Iraq, is up for a vote this week. With soldiers' lives on the line and Iraq teetering, it will pass. But the bill has grown and grown, while Iraq has moved closer to civil war than to stability. Hundreds of billions of scarce taxpayer dollars now spent on Iraq, $2 trillion by one count, and clearly more to come. Sums so big for a war so inconclusive that it's fair to ask, what else might they have bought for America's future and American security? Up next on Point, Iraq by the numbers and where else this massive investment might have gone. Joining me now for the latest on where President Bush's request for more emergency war spending stands is Charles Babington, congressional correspondent for The Washington Post. Charles, thanks for being with us. So what exactly is on the agenda with Congress and the war spending this week? What are they looking at? What's likely to happen?
What's likely to happen is that they'll be voting on a $91 billion emergency or supplemental spending bill. $20 billion of that will be for hurricane relief in the Gulf area, but about $71 billion to continue the fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. Even though there's a lot of growing concern, Tom, in both houses of Congress about spending levels in general, I think it's going to be very hard for them to deny the $71 billion for the war effort. There might be a bigger fight over the Katrina relief spending. This money is going to go through, but I think for the rest of the year, you're going to hear increasing arguments and debate about spending levels in general as we get towards the midterm election, in a sense among especially Republicans, that their party just has not done enough to curb spending.
And the majority of that $70 billion going to Iraq, nobody really talking about not spending it when there are troops in the field. But is there a sense in Congress, Charles, of how long this is going to go on? This is all outside the regular budget. As you say, it's emergency supplemental spending and has been ever since the beginning. Are folks on Capitol Hill now looking at a calendar and scratching their heads and saying, you know, this billions per month, how far, how long does this go?
I think there is that sense, Tom, but at the same time, because, of course, tragically, troops are dying, you won't hear it expressed in strict money terms, because mm-hmm. that will sound crass and cold. It is the greater concern, of course, is the deaths and injuries of U.S. military, the ultimate outcome of the war. So in a way, the spending, while very troublesome in some ways and problematic, will always take a back seat to the argument being cast in that way. And therefore, you're going to hear sharper arguments where you can go right to the point of spending on things such as, you know, spending to help people pay for home heating fuel, that sort of thing, where you can just hit the topic more head on.
2,300 U.S. deaths in Iraq now. Of course, you're right. That comes around to the question of withdrawal. There's a dollar ticker for every day we're there, but it's the soldiers in the end. Where do you see the conversation now about getting out? A majority of Americans now saying it was a mistake to send troops to Iraq, 55%. How's that filtering into Congress?
It's going to be the biggest issue, I think, in these House and Senate elections in November. The Democrats would like very much to make this a winning issue for them and critique the president's execution of this war in very severe terms. The problem they have there is that so many of their members did vote to authorize the war, mm-hmm. you know, way back when, and it's difficult. It's easy for them to say that this president has done a poor job of executing this war. I think there's pretty much unanimity on that question among Democrats. The much bigger task becomes, you know, well, what would you do differently? When should we withdraw? How should we withdraw? How should we hand over the warfighting capabilities to the Iraqis? And that's because that issue is so very, very difficult. The biggest problem for the Democrats is that they can criticize and attack in a way. It's much harder for them to propose an alternative.
And Charles, finally, how tight is the fiscal situation on Capitol Hill now? What is going begging as dollars go in these other directions?
Well, what a lot of critics would say face, you know, that nothing's going begging because we keep spending and spending and giving a lot of lip service to cutting the budget. But in fact, there's been very little of that, and that's why we're going to. One thing you're going to see in the next week or so is yet again raising the debt limit, the statutory debt limits, because we're going deeper and deeper into debt as a nation. And that's the debate that you're going to hear among some conservatives, is that all we've done is give lip service to significant cuts in any type of spending. You know, Tom, it's always easier to talk about the need to cut the budget and fiscal discipline and all that, but the truth is it's never been the top priority, even the top two or three or four priorities for the American public. And because of that, you know, members of both parties don't put it at the top of their list, and therefore it is usually more talk about cutting spending than carrying it out.
Is this emergency kind of supplemental spending ever going to be brought into the main budget, Charles? It's been left outside, but now the administration is talking about the long war. Does this ever become part of the formal budget consideration process?
Well, you know, maybe it will, if the public and the lawmakers finally decide. But I'm skeptical because it's so easy, it's convenient, you know, not to do it. It's like, you know, you and your wife saying, oh, well, let's go on a big Caribbean vacation, and we're not going to really consider it part of our budget, so therefore we're not busting our budget. And, you know, we've been fiscally responsible, and we still got our Caribbean vacation. Obviously, the way the government can do this is by borrowing and running up the national debt. And as long as the American people feel that debt limit is not unsustainable, then they'll probably continue doing it this way.
But at some point, the bill comes due all the same. Charles Babington, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Charles Babington, congressional correspondent for The Washington Post. He spoke with us from Washington. We're talking this hour about the mounting cost of the Iraq War and where else all those dollars might have gone. Joining me now in the studio is Linda Bilmes. She was Chief Financial Officer and Assistant Secretary for Management and Budget at the U.S. Department of Commerce from 1999 to 2001. She's currently a lecturer at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. She's co-author with Joseph Stiglitz of The Economic Costs of the Iraq War, an appraisal 3 years after the beginning of the conflict, which put the war's price tag at a widely debated but certainly eye-popping $2 trillion. Linda Bilmes, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
$2 trillion. People have pushed back on that. I mean, said it's less. You folded a lot into it. I guess there's this huge range now, people saying from 200 and some billion on Iraq all the way up to your high $2 trillion figure. By any measure, a lot of money and still going.
Right. Well, I think the actual cost of the war is much higher than it seems because there is a long tail of costs that we would have to pay even if we pulled out tomorrow. What you hear in Washington is the $250 billion that's been spent on combat operations in Iraq. But in addition to that, as I say, even if we pulled out tomorrow, we would be spending $100 to $200 billion on disability and health care benefits for the veterans who have already fought. We would be spending $100 to $200 billion on military hardware, that's equipment and weapons that have been used up but not replaced. And, of course, as Mr. Babington mentioned, we have borrowed all this money, so we have to pay interest on the money we have already borrowed. So even taking the most optimistic case possible, if we walked out of Iraq tomorrow, we would already have spent $600 billion.
And when you bring it up to $2 trillion, how long is that, presuming the war goes on?
Well, we looked at it using the Congressional Budget Office's two scenarios. The optimistic one is that all U.S. troops are home within 4 years, and their basic scenario is that we maintain a small presence through 2015.
So we're trying to get a sense this hour. I mean, we're there. We've got to get out responsibly. We've got to do the right thing. The president's going to be talking a lot about this week. At the same time, support for the war has plummeted, and the outcome, very unclear, whether there's going to be stability in Iraq, whether, in fact, we've pumped up Iran's strategic position, just as it's looking at nuclear arms. Which brings us around to the subject of where else that money might have been spent, and whether not just American roads and highways and ports or wherever it might have been aimed would be in better shape, but whether American security itself might be in better shape these 3 years after the invasion. How do you look at a question like that, Linda Bilmes?
Well, I think that we have to try and think in a way about not only the money that we've spent, but all of the cost that we didn't quantify in our study. For example, what is the impact on homeland security preparedness of the fact that we have 40% of our troops in Iraq coming from the National Guard and reserves? Now, we saw in Louisiana that there were 3,000 National Guardsmen who were in Iraq at the time of Katrina, 4,000 Mississippi National Guardsmen, and that was one of the reasons for the slowness of response. It is a direct trade-off between money that we spend in Iraq and money that we spend at home. And even quoting from the head of the Pontchartrain levee project in New Orleans, he says, quote, "It appears that the money has been moved in the president's budget to handle the war in Iraq, and I suppose that's the price we pay." Talking about the fact that he was not able to get his $22 million, not billion, for fixing the levies.
I've been joined in the studio by Linda Bilmes. She was chief financial officer and assistant secretary for management and budget at the U.S. Department of Commerce until 2001. We're joined right now as well from New York by Jeffrey Sachs, director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University. He's special advisor to U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan on the Millennium Project, big spending for poverty and hunger. He's author of The End of Poverty, Economic Possibilities for Our Time. Jeffrey Sachs, thank you for joining us.
Tom, it's a pleasure to be with you.
So we are where we are, and we've got to deal with it. And yet these numbers are so big that it seems worthwhile going back and running this tape again to kind of gauge our instincts, where we ended up, what the alternatives might have been, and how our security might have looked today on a different path. Jeffrey Sachs, you see these big numbers, whether it's a quarter trillion or a trillion or 2 trillion. When you look at these numbers spent on Iraq and think about, I know you have a global writ, but start with American security. How do you look at what the alternatives might have been with all that money?
Tom, I cry. When you and I talked about Iraq in September 10, 2003, I said, let's get out. This is absolutely a dead end. It's going to be killing our young men and women, and it's going to be costing us hundreds of billions of dollars. I remember at the time, you and a lot of listeners were pretty shocked at the idea that we should just get out. That was 2.5 years ago. And everyone said, oh, let's continue to try. And since then, we've probably spent $250 billion. We've lost thousands of lives of our own fellow citizens, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of lives of Iraqis. We have destroyed the U.S. Name in large parts of the world. And what have we done for our security? Of course, we've done nothing but do what was absolutely predictable. We've stirred up the hornet's nest even more. We've increased the levels of violence. And despite this idea, which is in virtually every U.S. document, that we have three pillars of our national security: our diplomacy, which we have undermined, our defense, and our help for development of unstable poor countries. This $250 billion, if it had been directed towards helping poor people, helping unstable societies, helping to fight disease, even a tiny fraction of it, we would have saved millions and millions of lives on the planet, burnished America's reputation, won hearts and minds, and tremendously increased our security. This has been one of the great debacles of American foreign policy.
Jeffrey Sachs, help us look at that in very dollar-oriented terms. We're going to be absolutely mercenary about that today. Because there's a million ways of looking at this, but the cost is a big one, and it's in front of Congress this week. What have the opportunity costs been here? We'll look with Linda domestically, but globally, if you're looking at $250 billion, you know, these numbers are so big, it's hard to understand what that might have done. Would that have been a drop in the bucket? Would that have made real difference in terms of poverty, disease, global stability? How do you see that number?
That number would have been enough to decisively control the AIDS pandemic, malaria, tuberculosis, other infectious diseases. We could have saved millions of lives per year for that. I'll just give you one example. The cost of controlling malaria, which will kill 2 to 3 million children this year, 2 to 3 million children, is $3 billion a year for all of sub-Saharan Africa. What is the United States doing right now? It's doing perhaps 100 to 200 million a few hours of Pentagon spending each year. I begged the administration this past year, do something on malaria, because this is the way you can stabilize societies. This is the way we can save millions of people, children who are dying these terrible and unnecessary deaths so easily.
So what happened, Tom, just in a nutshell,
they agreed to $1.2 billion over 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we spend $1.4 billion every day on the military. So they have given a five-year budget for the U.S. effort against malaria that is less than one day's military spending.
We feel your big heart in assessing that. We feel those millions of lives. At the same time, we want to look at this in a very hard-eyed way today, because Iraq is put forward as a security issue.
Yeah.
And I don't mean to diminish the lives whatsoever, but put it in security terms, in hard-eyed security terms for the planet, for the United States of America. What difference would that make?
Tom, maybe I was jumping ahead, but I had a visit from a senior military commander of the United States, a major general with tremendous responsibilities for security in Africa. He came to see me recently because he said, you know, there isn't a chance in the world that we can help create a stable environment in Africa, one where terrorism doesn't have its roots, one where there isn't a generation being recruited for some violent conflict or Al-Qaeda, one where one can actually have stable investments. We don't have a chance of that through a military approach. We need absolutely to face up to the hunger and disease crisis. This wasn't from me to him.
Mm.
This was from the major general to me.
Mm.
And this is known by anybody with eyes open right now, that we are seeing instability around the world, and all the U.S. image is that we are spending more on our military and more on military approaches than the entire rest of the world combined spends on the military right now.
Jeffrey Sachs, hold the thought there. Linda Bilmes, bring us home. The scale, as you say, is hard to grasp. We're trying to reach through the murk here. Let's just take the $250 billion. We can crank it up to your bigger number if you like later. But what American problems at home that intersect with security issues might that have solved, whether it's infrastructure or education, competitiveness, the ports we hear so much about? We're trying to get a sense as citizens of how to stack up these huge stacks of dollar bills.
Well, if you think about it in terms of monthly spending, how much we spend per month in Iraq, we spend about $6 billion per month. And I think it's helpful to compare it to a few other things that we actually already spend money on in the budget. Now, we spend per year $5 billion on cancer research. So we spend in the budget less in the whole year on cancer than we do in 1 month in Iraq. Another example is what we spend for the total budget for the United Nations. The total budget for the UN and all of its agencies is about $10 billion. So what we spend in Iraq in about 6 weeks. The U.S. is behind in about $500 million on its payments to the U.N. And whatever we think about the U.N., this money is basically held up over some internal management effort. And this is money that directly affects the ability of the United States to do U.N. peacekeeping, for example.
What about bread and butter issues at home? Schools, infrastructure, American highways? I mean, I've seen the numbers. Could we have, I don't know, could all American kids have good schools if we had spent some fraction of this money at home? Could we have fixed all the bridges and roads that are in such disrepair? Would that have had a security implication?
Well, sure. I mean, if there are 3 million teachers in the U.S. and they earn a median salary of about $45,000, which is not very much, and to raise that median to $50,000 would cost $20 billion. In other words, 3 or 4 months' worth of spending in Iraq.
To raise it for 1 year, for 10 years?
That's to raise it per year.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
To raise it to $50,000. So we're not talking about paying them a lot.
So that's to have, presumably, then better qualified teachers, and perhaps through that better qualified students, and the country becomes more competitive. There's a security payoff.
That's right. That's a direct payoff in terms of competitiveness and education quality for our youngsters, particularly in the poorer districts where an additional $5,000 a year for teachers would make a huge difference.
What about at the fiscal level? We hear so much about the Social Security problem, and it's out there and it's huge. Would the Iraq war money, does it begin if it had been allocated differently to address that issue? Has this been a trade-off?
Absolutely. We could have fixed the Social Security problem for the next 75 years if we had spent the money on Social Security instead of on Iraq. We also could have provided health insurance for all of the uninsured in the country. I mean, the scale of this spending, as Jeff Sachs said, is just so vast that there are so many problems that could have been fixed by diverting even some of this money to domestic problems, whether you're looking at health care for the uninsured, fixing the Medicare problem, fixing the Medicaid problem, fixing the problem of long-term care in nursing homes, fixing the Social Security problem, raising pay for nurses and teachers, as well as Homeland Security costs. Right now, 44% of police departments in the country have lost members of the police force because they are in Iraq. And so you have almost half the police forces in the country understaffed because of
National Guard call-ups.
Because of National Guard call-ups and reserve call-ups.
It's a long line of costs. I want to get our callers in here. Colin's calling from Arlington, Virginia. Hi, Colin. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
We're good. What do you think, Colin?
No, I think you're bringing up very good points about where we can put our money. But like you were talking about, to police, fire, and to Homeland Security, that same type of money, which is being funneled elsewhere in what seems to be a wasted effort, could do better for Homeland Security at home.
But Colin,
and might have helped with Katrina.
So think about Katrina, think about at home. But what about the security that's being bought in Iraq? What value do you put on that, Colin?
Well, the value is that, I mean, we're there. We can't get out, you know, at this point without spending the money. But what you're putting forward is a question of where could have the money have gone. You know, when you're in and you're stuck there, you know, the thing is, and that is going to be the debate, how to get out. It's going to be a lot more money. But I think the question you put out is a very, very tough one, and something that's a what if rather than what can we do now.
Exactly, and it makes us think back to how we got into this situation in the first place. Jeffrey Sachs, you remember the estimated costs for this war were much lower than what we've seen. $60 billion was one number from the White House. Others who estimated higher found themselves out of the White House, and now up goes the ticker.
Yeah, I think the point I would disagree with Colin is that we can get out. Again, Tom, you and I spoke 2.5 years ago about getting out. When you've made a terrible mistake, putting in $100 billion a year on top of it and thousands of lives lost, tens of thousands of Iraqi lives lost, more hate growing, this is not actually a sensible course. It wasn't sensible in March 2003 when this disastrous war was launched. It wasn't sensible in September 2003 when you and I talked and people were shocked at my thought that we should leave. Now it's 2.5 years later. I think most Americans now agree we need to get out. We should get out because we're not accomplishing anything staying in except this extraordinary lost opportunity that not only is a poor investment, it's a negative return. Net-net, it's just costing us outright losses without any countervailing benefits at this point.
And the money meter keeps running. William is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, William, you're on the air. How do you see it?
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure.
Well, I see it that we're probably narrowly framing the subject, I think, right now.
Blow it up for us.
All right. Let's assume that we go back to a month after 9/11, when the president believed there was a 10 kiloton weapon in Manhattan, and that came from, I believe, Graham Allison's book, and you had him on, I think, several months ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the president is given this information, which again was confirmed by the CIA, that there was a 10 KT weapon in Manhattan.
There was this suspicion, you're saying? I don't recall this specific allegation, but you're saying the president thought so. Okay.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
It was reported by the CIA and confirmed by Graham Allison.
Where are you going with that?
Well, I'm going with the fact if in fact it were true, and we were to vaporize Manhattan, then everything we're talking about here would be moot.
So how does it relate to the spending on the Iraq War?
Well, then the money is well spent on the Iraq War based upon the fact you do a risk analysis that says there is a nuclear weapon in the hands of Saddam Hussein.
But that's exactly
what... And there is a nexus between he and al-Qaeda, you know, though loose.
But that's exactly
there.
What took us to the war. The nexus was essentially disproved. The bomb wasn't found.
Well, the nexus, I don't think, was disproved. It was somewhat...
Pretty substantially. It's a fairly... But you're saying the risk was there. This is the mushroom cloud risk that we were warned of.
You've got to go back to the context of, you know, shortly after 9/11 to understand how the decision process ran.
Yep, and that's exactly...
And why it made sense.
But you've watched, as we've watched, as so much of the argument for the war has been... revealed as a kind of buffaloing from back then. I mean, how intelligence was pushed and the country was taken into this thing, and then there's no bomb, there's no weapon.
Well, I'm not sure it was pushed. I mean, we've had a number of allegations that we were lied to. A number of people have said that. They said that there was no yellow cake, no attempt to get yellow cake from Niger, which is the Brits still believe that's true, that Saddam did try and get yellow cake from Niger. I mean,
when we look back now, William, do you have any regret when you look at how this price ticker's going, you hear about the things that might have been done instead, are you still thinking we had no choice?
Certainly we can opine the mistakes that we made and the decisions were made, but the decisions were based on the best information available.
Well, that's one framing. We hear it loud and clear. Linda Bilmes, I want to come to you before the break. William, thank you for your call.
Yeah, I think one of the most important issues your caller raises is, you know, have we spent so much money that we are no longer prepared to fight another war should the need arise?
I'm not sure that's what he's raising, though. He's saying we had no choice at the time. The cost if something had happened with a nuclear weapon then was so great, we had no choice but to spend this money.
Well, the proposition at that point was we have a threat and we're going to spend $50 billion to take out that threat.
Mm.
The situation now is that that threat did not materialize. We've now spent at least $1 trillion on an occupation, which has turned out to be extremely expensive. And we have to look at the fact that the cost, the sort of unquantifiable cost, is the huge impact on our military forces.
I've been joined from the Earth Institute at Columbia University by Jeffrey Sachs. With me in the studio, Linda Bilmes. And joining us now from Washington is Michael O'Hanlon, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, co-author of Defense Strategy in the Post-Saddam Era. Michael O'Hanlon, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be with you.
It's a hypothetical conversation, we grant it, but the dollar figures are becoming so big that it seems worth doing, just to do a kind of gut check on this. Michael O'Hanlon, if that $250 billion or trillion, define it how you will, had been spent elsewhere, might we have bought more security than we've bought in Iraq?
It's possible, and I like the way you're framing the question, frankly, because I think it's a more useful way, especially as we think about Iraq in our history, it's a more useful way to assess it. I think that some of the criticism that suggests it was fundamentally an immoral or illegal war, to me, it's not as useful of a form of criticism. For one thing, we've now made the decision to invade, obviously.
We're there, yeah.
But also, you know, I think that it troubles me, just as it troubled me that Republicans would often criticize peacekeeping in the 1990s as America tried to use its ideals and its strength to advance the well-being of people around the world. Now, Democrats often mock the whole enterprise as if even the motivation behind it was somehow wrong because there's certain aspects of Mr. Bush's thinking they don't like. I think it's more useful to say, leave aside the morality, which I think was actually quite sound. Was it smart? And have we achieved our broader goals in terms of the war on terror and financially? To finally get to your question, my short answer would be it's becoming more and more dubious, even for those of us who are at least open-minded about the idea of the invasion in the first place. I think that especially as we see long-term costs continue to mount, that the idea that bringing a better life to the Iraqi people is worth it on those grounds becomes more dubious, because you could have done a lot of peacekeeping in a lot of places like Congo and Sudan for much less money combined.
And never mind the Iraqi people for a moment. Think about the American people. If you were king of the world, Michael O'Hanlon, it's 2003, March, 3 years ago, and you had $250 billion or $1 trillion, and your primary concern was American security. How can you imagine having spent it in alternative paths that might have put us in a better situation today?
Well, let me quickly say that, because I'm trying to come across in a balanced, analytical way.
Yes, please.
I'm still trying to get an answer to your question, which is so tough I don't have one yet. But I would also submit that the Persian Gulf is an area of such importance to the global economy that stability in that region matters leaving aside the fact that we know Saddam really didn't have meaningful links to al-Qaeda, that he himself was not going to be a short-term threat to the United States, but over time, his regime or his sons might have again mounted an attack on Kuwait or otherwise destabilized the region. So I think there is that strategic benefit to his overthrow. I'm not sure it's worth the cost, and that's where I think the calculation is pretty interesting. But Persian Gulf stability is undoubtedly a very important concern for us, and even if we got serious about alternative energy, as we should, I'm not sure we could leave the Persian Gulf entirely behind in our thinking. So
you might have dropped some cash there, but not necessarily a quarter or half or a full $1 trillion.
Well, although it's hard to say how much you would spend and get success. So to me, the problem is we didn't take this war seriously enough. We didn't execute it properly. We didn't execute it robustly. We didn't have a good plan for that first year after Saddam fell. In a way, even though I sympathize with your question, I think dwelling too much on the question would have actually reinforced the problem we had, which is you can't do this on the cheap. If you're going to do it, and maybe we had a good case to do it, you're going to have to do it robustly. And if you do it robustly, perhaps you can end it more quickly and save in the long term, but you don't go in with that attitude.
But we're told these are existential issues, so it seems fully legitimate to go back and kind of gut check our instincts at that time that took us to this decision,
right,
instead of another one. Jeffrey Sachs, Michael O'Hanlon says, look, you know, there were real security concerns in the Persian Gulf. You couldn't just ignore it. And yet, how do you see, Jeffrey, the kind of box of thinking that brought us to this decision rather than another? Because the dollars have followed the decision.
I think this was a most disastrous decision, and predictably so, and widely predicted. And this was a hyped war that anyone with the background could see. It was clear that putting American young men and women in an occupying army in Iraq was going to lead to disaster, and it has. And it just does seem to me important to understand this, because everyone now that says, well, we're here, we have to stay, is just, again, shedding millions of lives, actually. That's a point that is hard for people to understand, by what we're not doing. What we're not doing with this vast amount of money, even a tiny fraction of it, could give America a role in the world that would enormously protect America. You said, is it Tikrit or Tennessee? Let me add, or Tanzania,
mm-hmm,
or other places where we can do things that would be amazing for the whole world in inspiration, in direct contribution to reduction of conflicts, in enabling societies to be stable. And that's what our national security policy says we're going to do. It says that a world where some live in comfort and plenty while half the human race lives on less than $2 a day is neither just nor stable, and that it is one of America's top international policy priorities to expand the circle of development. That's in the U.S. national security doctrine. But what do we actually do about that?
Mm-hmm.
Almost nothing.
Michael O'Hanlon, you're a straight security guy here, but security, you know, with a very capital S, can cover a lot. And when you get into these very large dollars, they could have had global impact. Do you begin to look at that trade-off? It's a trade-off we've made as a country, as a security analyst. Right. Is that on your screen?
Yeah, and it should be. And by the way, it's an honor to be on with Mr. Sachs, who's done so much in this area. But I would differ with him only on one point, which I think is an important one, which is that President Bush, as Mr. Sachs knows well, has increased development assistance to other countries even as he's waged this war. Now, it's not to say that he's done it in a way that's economically sustainable. We have a huge deficit in this country, and there are real opportunity costs. But I would submit that we don't have to view every single decision in foreign policy as this versus the other thing. Part of what we need is a broader vision of what our national security is. And rather than say we're spending too much on defense, I would rather say we're not spending enough on development. I think that Mr. Bush has done one thing correctly, which is to elevate the priority of foreign policy. Obviously, 9/11 did that largely for him, but he continued on with it. And I give him a lot of credit that at least on one area, development assistance, he has increased the dollars a substantial amount. Not as much as he should.
No, but Michael, it's just not true. That's the problem. These are the things that are said, but it's just not true. What we're spending this year on defense is somewhere up to $550 billion. What we're spending on development assistance is something like $17 or $18 billion, half of which goes to the war zones to begin with. What we're spending on Africa is probably $3.5 billion. It's a myth that we're actually directing aid to development. It's just not true, though it is said. You're repeating what is
claimed about development assistance.
I mean, the dollars do go there, Jeffrey Sachs. You're just saying the scale is mismatched?
No, I'm saying that you can pretend that we're actually doing things that we're not when we're spending, in all of Africa, 750 million people with disease, with avian flu risks, with instability, with Al Qaeda, with hunger, with Darfur, with all of that, we spend 2 days of military spending.
Michael O'Hanlon, are you suggesting the U.S. could do it all? I thought our fiscal situation was such we had to make choices, and we have.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, as a former Peace Corps volunteer and then Zaire, I agree very much with Jeffrey Sachs' overall argument. hey, come on.
Bravo. I agree with you. But we got to explain to the people how little we're doing right now because they don't understand the relative magnitudes.
Yeah, but, you know, you should also critique me on points that I make instead of straw man that you're setting up.
No, I didn't mean to set up a straw man. I mean to help the American people understand that.
Let me finish instead of interrupting.
Sorry.
The point is, Mr. Bush has increased development assistance quite a bit, not nearly enough. But the point is, if you say that if only we didn't spend this money on Iraq, we would have spent it elsewhere, that is not true, as you well know. We would have had to motivate the country to spend more money more generally. Now, I agree with you in the end, and I think the Tom's question is right on the money. Can you do both these things indefinitely? The answer is no. But in the short term, Mr. Bush has made at least something of an increase in foreign aid, and I think that's a fact that should be on the table rather than further polarizing the debate that has already gotten so destructive in this country. But I agree with every substantive point you make otherwise.
Michael Hanlon, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, author of Defense Strategy in the Post-Saddam Era. Michael, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Suzanne's calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Hi, Suzanne. You're on the air.
Hi. Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make the simple point that where we backtracked in international policy, and I think it's remarkable that Mr. Hanlon gives Bush any credit for promoting good international policy. In fact, I think this administration has set us back decades. It's the Karl Rove type of irrational thinking politics where we can manipulate the masses through fear. Jeffrey Sachs is one of the few people that represent logical thinking with pragmatic decisions, taking into account real numbers, real statistics, you know, really recognizing international condition and how impact of poverty and economics really affect our national security.
But Susan,
as
let
well
me ask
international
you.
Security. So we backtracked. 9/11 was just another kick in the pants of setting us back even farther. Instead of making, we just totally started making irrational, poorly supported, logical decisions after 9/11.
But would we have spent this money in some better way?
The terrorists have won because we are economically impoverishing ourselves, making bad international policy that impairs our security.
Suzanne, we've got it. We appreciate your call. Linda Bilmes, bring us back home again. I mean, Americans look at infrastructure that's in trouble, and we look at Congress and are told, you know, we've spent a lot, we've run up a big debt, but we can't do it all. We can't have better schools. We can't pay more here. We can't do more there. You know, on the security front, could we have spent this money? Would we have spent this money in a way that might have brought us more security at home?
Well, I think if you look at the scale of what we're spending on the Homeland Security Department, for example, we are spending about $41 billion for the Department of Homeland Security this year, and we will spend about three times that on the war in Iraq. Now, what does the Homeland Security Department pay for? It pays for things like the Coast Guard, mm-hmm. which is patrolling the ports, for example. It pays for customs. It pays for a whole range of things which directly protect our homeland security. And that department, which is a collection of 22 different agencies that have been brought together, is having a great deal of trouble integrating, teaching the different agencies in the department to communicate with each other, to share information. They need a huge infusion of money to be able to work more effectively. They also have a problem in that most of the senior people in that Department of Homeland Security are getting older or close to retirement. They're not training and hiring enough new people. So that is an area where there's a direct trade-off between the money that we just simply do not have for Homeland Security to protect our ports and air traffic controllers mm-hmm. and other areas because we're spending it in Iraq.
You keep coming right back to the front line in the American security effort at home, and reasonably so. I understand that. I also think, though, about American competitiveness, about the education of American kids, about our fiscal future, the Chinese government holding so much American debt. Surely those are security issues as well. Do you see those as having been dinged, as having been shortchanged because of the tab from Iraq?
Absolutely. We are now in a situation where we are borrowing an unprecedented amount of money, $7 or $8 trillion. And this is, when you think about it in terms of our GDP, that's $8 trillion compared to a GDP of about $13 trillion. That's a lot of debt for us to be carrying. And the increasing portion of this debt is being purchased essentially by Japan and China. Many people have talked about the potential dangers of having so much debt being held by China, not even assuming that there is anything that goes wrong in China, but simply if the Chinese decide to spend more of that money rather than to invest more of it in the U.S., following their own self-interest, as every country does. And so we have exposed ourselves, due to the fact that we have borrowed so much money for this war, to a great deal of the vicissitudes of the international debt markets.
Becky's calling from Grand Isle, Vermont. Hi, Becky. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much.
Sure.
My concern is that the Bush administration has consistently been invested in a simplistic, unsophisticated sort of xenophobic view of the axis of evil, rather than looking at why it is that countries are willing to, why people are willing to become suicide bombers, why people are willing to just give up everything, because they really don't have a lot to live for.
But 9/11 seemed to lean the other way. These weren't impoverished guys who jammed into those towers.
But, Tom?
Yes, Jeffrey?
They were based in an impoverished, unstable country, Afghanistan.
Well, based there, but they came from oil-rich countries.
It doesn't matter. The point is that the instability in this world, if we address it, we dry up the support for this kind of terror. We have to go to the real fundamentals. We will never have enough troops to be able to handle this, like the Major General told me. We have to go to something a little bit more thoughtful in our response.
Becky, in Vermont, is that the way you're looking at it?
That's exactly the way I'm looking at it, and it really concerns me that I think that Bush and his administration really needs to have that external enemy to try to unify the country around him, and that certainly began in 9/11. I mean, his poll ratings, I think, are lower now than they were before that, but that, you know, he's really needed to hold on to that whole view, that fear that's uniting the country in some ways against external enemies in favor of Bush. I think Jeffrey Sachs should run for president.
Becky, thanks very much for your call. Jeffrey, do you see the thinking of the country having changed over these 3 years? The tab is very big now. Linda Bilmes lays it out in detail for us. But has it changed the country's instincts when it's attacked, when it's assaulted? Or are we always going to reach for the gun instead of for a broader set of spending, if we're going to do it, that might end up giving us more security?
Well, I think the country has absolutely been amazed at the misdirection, the lies, and the incompetence of the administration in dragging us into this mess. And that's reflected in all of the surveys. It's reflected in the opinions of the troops on the ground in Iraq, as well as the American people. But this fear factor is very real, and what fear can do is unlock any kind of response. That's why national leadership matters so much, because when the country is fearful, as it of course was after 9/11, it basically says to the leadership, make us safe. And if we're taken in a absolutely unsafe direction, well, the public's going to follow for quite a while until it sees the results. But the American people are very pragmatic. They see we're not getting the results. We're not getting the security. They are groping for a new direction right now, a peaceful direction, a more fundamentally correct direction to the challenges of the world.
Well, we're on an expensive learning curve, but we're looking to learn. Jeffrey Sachs, author of The End of Poverty at Columbia University, thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
And Linda Bilmes, lecturer at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Linda, thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.